I think the news is all about private credit, but this time it's in the negative way.
Yeah.
We're spending a lot of time answering all those questions and breaking down some of the allegations. But markets were very tight. It was a very competitive market. Leads to bad vintage. They don't like benign markets. We can't outperform, and you're just chasing spreads tighter and tighter and tighter. You want dispersion. You want, just like an equity investor, people don't lose money in credit because of defaults in a diversified portfolio.
Hi, welcome back to Winged and Ready. We're at the beginning of the second quarter, 2026. I'm very pleased to be sitting here with a good friend and our head of private credit at UBS, Joe Shortino. Joe and I thought it would be really wise and clever and appropriate for us to revisit our private credit conversation from about a year ago. So Joe, thanks so much for being here. We're in the Port Washington Library podcast studio yet again, and a lot's happened in the last year.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be back. It was just over a year ago that we talked, and I went back and listened to that podcast, and actually we covered a lot of ground there, and a lot of that has actually come to fruition today. I think the news is all about private credit, but this time it's in the negative way.
Yeah.
And we're spending a lot of time answering all those questions and breaking down some of the, I wouldn't say allegations, but claims about private credit and the bad things going on. And just a lot of it's unfounded.
Right.
And I think it's more of an indictment on the journalism industry than really the private credit industry.
Yes.
You know, these articles, they're written in a way to get clicks, and that's what they're doing. They're marketing themselves as journalists. And I go back to, you know, right around year end, there was an article written by a Bloomberg reporter where it was really written about the redemptions at year end, but that in the first paragraph, they mentioned Tricolor, First Brands, Jamie Dimon, and cockroaches.
Yeah.
Had nothing to do with the article.
Right.
But if you Google those terms, his article will come up and you'll click on it. And that's how he gets paid. So, you know, I guess the old saying is if it bleeds, it leads. And private credit's bleeding a little bit right now.
Yeah. And I really want to dig into this. I am very enthusiastic about the topic, especially because I believe in private credit as an asset class. And I think people should be well versed on it and to understand it, even if it's understanding enough to then follow up with experts such as yourself to ask questions. I wanna go back a little bit though, because if you're new to private credit and if you're new to Winged and Ready, you should go back and listen to our podcast from last year, because we cover things like illiquidity in the space, how it plays a role in your portfolio. And we talk high level about the diversification benefits of private credit, as well as some of the basic terminology. So we won't go through a lot of that today because it's already there for your private credit 101.
Yeah, that was in February of last year, and you named it Go Ahead, Take Credit.
Go ahead.
Which I thought was great.
Take credit. and you should go ahead and take credit for bringing this important topic. I love that you just talked about clickbait a little bit. As somebody who is a financial advisor at UBS in our Jericho office, I have in recent months found it more of a challenge to have people and or institutions allocate to the asset class. And I believe that they're overall portfolios are not representing the right risk level that they should be because they don't have exposure to the asset class. So why are people so afraid of credit right now?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to ignore all of the articles and headlines that are in your face. In fact, we think the same thing. You know, we always say, is there something that we're missing? And we dig into all of these claims or allegations, whether it's mismarking portfolios or overlap between portfolios. And it always comes back to the math. And I talked about this in the last time. It's really about numbers. It's not about my opinions on things. So I can have an opinion on something, but I always back it up with the numbers. So for example, there was a lot being said about mismarking your portfolio. And one of the
What does that mean to mismark a portfolio?
Right. So these are private loans. So the marks are not, out in Bloomberg. You can't look it up. You can't get what the price of the loan is. When liquid markets get volatile, the supply demand of that, trade is what marks the portfolio. So one guy comes in and says, I'll buy, it's just like stocks. I'll buy that loan for 99. Another says, I'll buy it for 98, and it clears at some price. Well, if it's not trading and it's a private loan, then what is the mark? And there's a lot of different ways to mark a portfolio, and we could have an argument of what the proper way is. But the plain and simply, all of these institutional quality lenders have a third party that comes in and either marks the portfolio or verifies the mark in some way. We require that at UBS. We will not invest in any fund that doesn't have an independent process to price the underlying loans.
It's not just pulling a number out of thin air,
Correct.
but people think it is.
Correct. And that's because generally, most of these loans are priced at par. They're priced at the origination value. And that's because they're performing. So if I give you a loan and you pay me every month the interest, why am I supposed to mark that loan down? Now, when the liquid market trades down because of some noise, some people would say, well, how come your private loan isn't trading down? It's not marked down. Well, it's not actively traded. That's why. So it's held to maturity. That's the difference.
And
So it
that's a diversification.
that's correct. And it's very important to look at their portfolios, dig into the portfolios, and look at the underperforming loans and make sure that those are marked properly. And they are. And we do this analysis. One of the misnomers about private credit is it's opaque. It's not. These are regulated, and we're talking about the large BDCs, the business development companies that are run by the Apollos and the Blackstones and the Oaktrees, and the Ares. And those are SEC registered products, and they file a 10-Q every single quarter with the entire portfolio listed out. So anyone, you, me, grandma, can download the portfolio, take a look at it, throw it into Claude and tell it to analyze it, and it does. And it actually does a pretty good job, actually. We'll get into AI later. So we do this. We evaluate all these portfolios. We talk to the managers. We actually get what we call an enhanced monitoring spreadsheet from them that gives their portfolio and
That
breaks it
sounds
out
cool.
into intricate details, like really, really detailed statistics about the portfolio. But we compare that to what is independently filed to make sure that it's all, works together. And what we found was remarkably, there's no mismarking. In fact, the marks were so close, it was actually shocking to me because it is a liquid credit. You would expect, one valuation agent to use one methodology, another to use a different methodology, and there's some difference between those marks. The real thing about marking is when a company becomes distressed, then nobody knows what the mark is, right? Nobody's trading it.
Because there's no market for it.
Right. So, it's, if your house is on fire and you want to sell it, who knows what the price is, right? I mean, that's basically what you're saying. So at those points, you can get big differences in marks. But generally, that's not really a story. But it does get clicks and it does make people nervous. And one of the things I didn't touch on in the last podcast is my job is both institutional and wealth. So I cover discretionary accounts that are large institutions, and we run money for them. But then I also am responsible for the wealth channel at UBS and bringing product to the wealth channel, monitoring that product. And we use the same methodology across. So everything I'm doing for my discretionary investments, we're doing for the wealth channel as well. And I'm always surprised that when I meet wealth clients that they don't really know that we're going through that process, that we're very hands-on with our investments, making sure that the managers are doing the right thing, making sure that the portfolios are healthy and that they're being represented properly. And that's a big part of my job.
That's an awesome part of your job. I know. I appreciate it. So thank you very much. And I think as you're doing an apples to apples comparison and what gets put on our platform at UBS, what people don't quite understand is the construction of those portfolios. And back to the clickbait, a lot of the words and terminology that are used, like in the Bloomberg article you cited, are regarding loans and loan types that may not even exist in the portfolios that you're
Or
evaluating.
they can be a very small piece. I mean, I there was one article about Blackstone marking down some loan that was marked it down $30 million. You know, this is a $70 billion portfolio of loans. It's a rounding error. It doesn't have any effect on the portfolio. You know, so trying to make news out of small issues is really what a lot is going on. However, on the other hand, I will say, and we talked about this a year ago, markets were very tight. It was a very competitive market. There was a lot of money flowing into direct lending specifically, and that leads to, you know, bad vintages. And that's what I think the market is going to deal with. There are some bad vintages. You look at like 2021 was a bad vintage. You probably have a weak vintage in 2024. You know, early 2025. But that's normal. That's part of credit. In fact, you talk to any real credit investor, they don't like benign markets. We can't outperform, and you're just chasing spreads tighter and tighter and tighter. You want dispersion. You want, just like an equity investor, you want some volatility. And that's what gives you the opportunity to really perform for clients. So I don't look at the forward-looking market as a risk. I look at it as a real opportunity. And we're gearing up trying to figure out where there's going to be pockets, whether that's going to be in shipping or whether that's going to be in software loans or whether it's going to be in consumer loans. And we're ready to take advantage of that. And that's how we manage money.
I think that's so incredibly important. If I could stand on this table and jump up and down and flail my hands all over the place
You
and
can.
say, please look at where alternatives have a role in your portfolio. Unfortunately, the mindset of a lot of people, whether they're in wealth or in institutional, is still set towards a everything's in the liquid market. Stocks and bonds. And people really don't understand how much of that doesn't exist anymore. The
That's
opportunities
right.
in the public space just do not exist the way they did even 10 years ago. And you want the same types of returns that were so popular and widely talked about, but you have to go into private markets to get those returns.
If you're not investing in private markets, you're doing your clients a disservice. You have to be investing in private markets. And whether that's real estate, infrastructure, private equity, private debt, to your point, the public market has shrunk tremendously over the last decade. To access opportunities, you have to be in privates. But like everything, it's a market. There's an ebb and flow to it. It's a living, breathing ecosystem. So you want to diversify, and you have to understand that it's illiquid, and you're just going to have to hold it through the bumps in the road. But that's okay. You know, that's the real mismatch today is many of these products that have regular liquidity that are evergreen. I don't know if they were sold incorrectly or people misunderstood them or just the expectations were wrong. But people think of them as quarterly liquidity products, but they're not. They're still the same illiquid, you know, underlying asset, just like the closed-end funds that were 5 to 7 years long. You should think about them as 3-year minimum to 5-year type time horizon. And as long as you're investing that way and building your portfolio that way, they play an enormous role. They're very stable products. They produce higher, more attractive returns. And as I think we discussed last time, having a nice, core of alternatives allows you to play offense on the other side of your portfolio.
Yep.
So if you have, a portfolio of private equity, private credit, and the markets trade down, you can go to your clients and say, now's a good time to shift a little more money into the liquid markets. Let's take it out of our fixed income portfolio. Let's regenerate the cash flow into equities and play offense. And I think that's the way institutions are looking at the markets, and that's the way all wealth investors should be looking at the markets as well.
I think that's a really important and critical point. I believe a lot of investors typically think if you're going to be making an adjustment in the portfolio, they're viewing it as a reallocation. But with the way markets behave, you have to be ready to make small adjustments here and there and to be able to take advantage of the opportunity that's at hand. And that doesn't always mean you have to reallocate. I can tell you institutional clients that we both work with operate in bands, right? They have their bands of their asset class, and that way they don't have to go back to their board or their committees when they're making adjustments. They know they can hold 3 to 7% cash, or they can hold 5 to 20% in private investments. And it's under that guise that the best outcomes for their portfolios will be making adjustments within those bands. I don't think the wealth clients are able to embrace that approach comfortably enough if they've not given full discretion and they just don't say you look at it because I don't want to. But if they have some say in it, they think every small adjustment is a big decision.
Yeah, that's true. And that's exactly the way we manage for our portfolios. Even within credit, we kind of have the same thing. So you look at the sub asset classes, and all the different statistics around how we build our portfolios, we think the same way. And you can shift around the margin, but it makes a big difference. And I think, we talk about, shifting to shorter duration assets when markets are tight. We sort of hide out, right? And we hide out in short duration assets because they're more conservative and they turn over quicker. And it sort of takes you out a lot of the market noise. So that's what we've been doing. And that allows us to play more offense when there's an opportunity set coming your way. And I think that's coming our way now. We're trying to bring that mentality to the wealth channel. So with new products, whether it's closed-end products that are more opportunistic, like capital solutions or commercial real estate, maybe on the more stressed side, as well as more diversified asset backed, which is shorter duration type evergreen strategies, where we can create diversification within the income bucket for clients.
And I just want to throw out to listeners too, if he and I are getting excited and throwing out a lot of nomenclature and you want to ask us any questions, please feel free to reach out to me, and I'm happy to ask Joe directly any questions you may have, or field whatever I can as well. Just going to plug in my phone number here. It's 516-745-8964 or diane.johnston@ubs.com. So wanted to footnote that if a concept sounds like something that's new or you want to understand better, let us know. We're happy to talk about it. But I want to glom on to the sub asset class for a minute and maybe keep poking holes in some of the press's approach to this. Can we talk about payment in kind?
Yeah, and we did touch upon this before too. There's a lot of noise around payment in kind, and to some extent, there's a good reason for it, because increased PIKs or payment in kind can be a sign of stress within the portfolio, but it's not that simple, right? You can provide a loan to a growth company, and you give them a PIK toggle, which means, let's say it's a 500 spread. If you're giving a growth company, it's probably closer to 600. And so 600 over the risk-free rate. So SOFR plus 600 is what you're getting paid. But they may have an option to toggle the PIK, and instead of it becoming 600, it's 650, but only half of that they're paying in cash.
Right.
Now, you would provide that to a growth company that's trying to build up their portfolio. Let's say it's a roll-up strategy or whatever it is, and they have to make purchases to grow their company, and that's what's going on. So it's a very healthy company that's growing very fast, and they're using that cash in a positive way, and that's why you provide that PIK there. It's good for both the lender and the borrower. The lender's getting paid more, right, because the spread goes up or the income goes up, and the borrower is growing, so the lender feels really comfortable. And it's good for the company because you're providing them the flexibility that they need to grow their company. That's why a company like that will go to private markets, because they can't get that in the public market. So that flexibility is a key component to attracting really high quality companies to private markets. And especially at the larger end, you're seeing a lot of that, where companies are really looking for more flexibility, and that's why they're opting for private versus public. That's a good pick. But if you have a company that's not doing so well, and they have a pick toggle, and they pick because they don't have the cash, or they're seeing their cash reserves being depleted because the company's going through some stress, so they pick, that's a bad pick.
Yeah.
So just having a pick number doesn't mean anything. So going back to our enhanced monitoring, what do we do? So we break down pick into different categories. Was it pick at origination, or was it pick after origination? Is the pick of the loan priced at par? Is it priced at 95, or is it priced at 89? Well, a company that's picking priced at par is very different than a company that's picking at 89. So when you break down the
I'm going to
portfolio,
hop in and say, think of par as 100 when you're
that's
talking
correct.
about
Sorry.
par and 100.
Yeah. Par is 100, right? It's not a par four. So, when you really look at a portfolio, you can't just look at these headline numbers. I think last time we talked about default rate, I kind of gave the example, there's not really a lot of defaults because in the private markets, they get ahead of it. So they do an exchange, they do a reworking of the docs, the debt. So default rate's always low. So now people are talking about picks. But to the regular investor, how are they going to break down what that pick is and whether it's good or bad? If you're like Blue Owl and you're investing in a lot of tech companies, you're going to have a very high percentage of pick. It's just the nature of that sector.
At origination.
At origination, doesn't mean it's bad. So we have to peel that onion back, not just one layer, but really like three layers to get to the core of whether it's good and bad. And actually, Lincoln Financial does a great job of this from a market perspective. And what you see is when they break down the pick, and what's good pick versus bad pick is really concentrated in smaller companies. So larger companies have been doing well, smaller companies have been struggling. And I think that's actually emblematic of the entire credit market today. It really is this K economy. And I don't normally buy into these sort of, things that come out like marketing kind of terms and stuff like that. But when we look at each different asset class, you do see this K economy kind of coming through the numbers.
Yeah.
Lower end consumers are struggling, higher end consumers are doing great. Smaller companies are struggling, larger companies are doing great. Subprime auto is struggling, but prime auto is doing great. So that's kind of what's going on. And I think it's just inflation is hitting the lower end credits much harder than the higher end credits.
Yeah, and in our first podcast too, we touched on how credit's everywhere. It touches your every day. Everybody sees private credit everywhere. And in that K economy sketch you just gave us, I was already thinking in my head, people don't realize that they're aware of these different types of credits and the quality of them just from their everyday life. They have seen, you can come buy a car at this dealership, no matter your credit, we will extend you credit
Right.
and you can get a car. That's the same thing that you're talking about with the smaller companies that are struggling and the quality. So people Yes, it sounds complicated. Yes, it sounds opaque, but everybody conceptually really has had exposure to this.
It is funny. I never understood why credit is hard for people to understand when every day we all deal with credit all the time, right? Whether you're talking about taxes or buy now, pay later, or your mortgage or your auto loan, all of it all ends up in my market, right? In one form or another. Is that going back to the financial crisis? There's that great cartoon about subprime mortgages and like the subprime mortgage when it gets originated and then where it goes into a CDO and eventually it ends on like the desk of some insurance company in Sweden and it's on fire. And it is very funny though that people don't know when they take out that auto loan what happens to it. And you get notices, Chase Bank sold your auto loan to some company you never heard of, and it goes into securitization, and then it goes into the private market, and it travels. And that's really what we follow. Now, the great thing is there's tons of data on all of these markets. So if you're really want to fall asleep, you can come to our strategy meeting, which is about 3 hours long every month, and we go through.
Is that an invitation?
It's a threat, where we go through all of the numbers around multifamily housing, around single family housing, around construction starts, around consumer lending, around subprime auto. We want to get all of this data because it gives you a better mosaic of what's really going on in credit markets. And you see it because when spreads are really tight, when everyone's giving subprime, auto loans, you're like, oh, that's an area to avoid because it's very easy to get that. Easy credit. That's a very loose credit box, as we like to say, right? What we're looking for is where the credit box is the tightest. I mean, there's not a lot of money funding those areas. And, I think we talked about Silicon Valley Bank last time, but one of the areas that's still very tight from a credit perspective is construction lending. Commercial real estate has gone through some stress. It's probably the only asset class that has repriced since rates going up. Right after COVID, and then you had the regional bank crisis, which pulled a lot of dollars out of commercial real estate construction funding. So there, you're getting paid a nice premium for the risk versus other asset classes.
Yeah, action reaction. And that's where you find opportunity.
That's right.
I want to help listeners characterize things. We keep, or at least I keep going back to the articles. So some of the things that have frustrated me when people send me questions that I want to unravel for them is a lot of the news stories will deal perhaps with a bad form or a bad payment in kind or a loan that was a syndicated loan. And then they will throw in a bunch of household names around private credit in that same article. And then you had said earlier that they'll put in a lot of words and terminology so that they funnel to the top of the ChatGPT or Google search, which I think is putting investors at a disadvantage because then they are avoiding managers that you have done a lot of due diligence on that actually have good quality opportunities in these different areas of private credit, whether it's commercial real estate, infrastructure, some of the BDC structures we talked about. And just from a high level, we don't have to pick out any one particular manager, but when you're looking at the larger managers, the ones, I'll say the ones that, we have screened and have approved, when these articles come out and they're, let's say they're talking about a pick, what percentage of
The
the
portfolio?
portfolio would that typically look like?
Yeah, I mean there are some positions that can be larger, and larger is like 3-4%, but generally these funds have in the BDCs have hundreds of positions. So if you own a few BDCs, you're talking about very minor positions. And overlap is, you should think about overlap as being around 20%. Now, there are some managers that have, stylistic similarities where overlap could be higher. So, for instance, Blackstone and Blue Owl both have very large tech lending groups. So they both do a lot of that. So there's a little more overlap between those types of funds. But yeah, they're highly diversified, and a lot of this is just, again, the noise of trying to get a click versus what's reality. And that's part of what I'm trying to do as the wealth side is to get people to know us. We're actually doing sort of a mini strategy meeting that we're going to make available for people. So they see, this is my team, this is what we do, this is how we analyze the portfolios, and we break it down into really detailed analysis, and we monitor any kind of problem children in that portfolio. You're always going to have problem children,
Right.
right? If anyone, I have four kids. There's always
So
one
do
of them. There's always
I.
one of them that's a problem. My wife will say she's got five kids with me.
I say the same thing.
If you don't have issues in your portfolio, you're not taking enough risk, right? So that's something that you're never going to have a perfect
Right. Because
portfolio.
risk is a good thing. You just
That's
don't
just
want
what it is.
outsized risk.
And it's really about how do you have the ability to manage those workouts, manage those risks. And that's why if you look at what we've done at UBS, we've really focused on the larger groups. They have the most resources. They have the ability to manage through any of these issues. They're also focused in the larger part of the segment of the market, which happens to be doing well.
I've heard some of them say boring is beautiful
I
because
mean,
they're.
this is senior secured risk. We're not doing things where they're highly concentrated, taking very specific company type risk or anything like that. Right, you just want to earn your income and go home.
Yeah, I talked to another asset manager. I'm obviously not using names, but about their payment in kind and their. Payment in kind that was non-performing was like 0.0046 of
Right.
the portfolio. Like, it's such a small, we're talking
We have
decimal
funds that have
points.
zero
It's
non-accruals.
so teeny tiny.
Right. Now,
But the press is going to hop all over it
right.
and make you think that if you invest in that, that's all you're getting.
Well, I mean, let's talk about software, right? So software is all over the news. And software and the liquid market has traded down, 10, 15 points. Nothing has happened actually in software. There are no defaults because of AI. Zero. So why is this going on? It's speculation. And it's speculation not about like what's happening tomorrow, what's going to happen 2, 3 years from now. So
Yeah.
now people ask me, like, well, what's your opinion? I don't have an opinion on what AI is going to do in software. I mean, I'm the last person. I threw out Claude because it's the only one I know, So it's, that's not my job to have an opinion on what disruption AI is going to have in the software industry and what that's going to mean for software loans. My job is to find people who do know that and do know that, who are experts in software, who have big teams of lenders and experience, people who come from the software industry, who can really analyze companies, and not just what the impact of AI is going to be on software, but what that company is going to do to evolve
Right.
over time and use AI to their benefit. So that our job is to find who knows what we don't know. I always say, like, know what you know what you don't know, but find who knows what you don't know, and that's who you partner with, right? I don't fix my car, but I know a good mechanic. That's
Right.
kind of what my whole job is.
Right. I want to talk about so seeing no defaults in software. Again, we've had a lot of headline risk around software. So if it's not the sector and it's not the space, I think there's a word that starts with an R that might be have been a problem. And some of the asset managers are trying to do the right thing by their shareholders, but that may have backfired on them. Can we talk about redemptions for a minute?
Yeah, so, and unfortunately, you can't just do your job. You also have to handle the press. And Blue Owl has had a difficult time doing that. And they're in the crosshairs from the beginning, and they just can't get out. And again, it's just kind of this vicious circle of the name Blue Owl, leads to clicks. So until they can get through it,
So it's like they're being trolled.
yeah, that's kind of what it's gonna be. So I actually kind of feel bad for them because they're trying to do the right thing. They've provided liquidity to their investors across funds, and they're going to get redemptions, which is fine. There's 5% gates, and that's what it's there for. And they've got plenty of liquidity in their portfolios, the ones that we follow, and they'll continue to manage through that. Now, who knows what happens in the past? Sometimes you see products where it becomes no longer viable, so you put it into liquidation and you get the money when the loans pay off, and that's what happens, right? We've done that on our discretionary side very, very often. In fact, the bulk of our portfolio on the discretionary side is through custom accounts. So our liquidations are always just based on the assets, not on some arbitrary gate. Unfortunately, I don't love the way these BDCs are set up where they have these fund level gates, because it creates a little bit of a game theory, right? Okay, am I going to redeem? Well, if I want to trim 10% and I think they're going to gate, maybe I'll redeem 20% and hopefully get the 10%. And if I get more, well, I can always reinvest, right? So it does create this issue with that. But that's the structure that the SEC provided. It is, again, an SEC registered account. They have to provide it that way. And one of the things that's misunderstood is that redemption mechanism is on gross, not on net flows.
So what does
So
that mean?
exactly. So let me explain this. So at year end, Fund XYZ has $1 billion. So they take that $1 billion and they say, we're going to register 5% of that billion as shares and tender for them, meaning we'll buy back 5% of the shares on $1 billion. That's set now for the end of the first quarter. XYZ Fund can raise another billion, it can raise zero, it doesn't matter. If they breach that 5%, then they gate. And that's the mechanism. So some of these funds, and I don't name which ones, but some of them actually raised money during the first quarter. So their fund grew, but they still have to gate because they're receiving more redemptions gross than the 5%. They don't net subscriptions and redemptions. And that's, again, the mechanism
It's a
for
mismatch.
these registered funds. If it was a private fund, a non-registered, it was non-BDC, they would be able to net that out. So there's some good and bad about the BDCs. From a tax perspective, it's very attractive. It makes it very easy for investors to invest the subscription methodology and all that. But it comes with this gating mechanism, which you have to.
And should not hopefully be a issue because it's being exploited in the press.
Well, and the realistically, what we really focus on is the liquidity of the portfolio. And liquidity can come from three different areas. Number one is cash. Obviously, you have unencumbered cash, that's liquidity. You have but part of that unencumbered cash is unencumbered leverage. So if a fund is typically levered up to one turn and the fund today is only a half turn leverage, well, they've got a lot of leverage leeway. And in some cases, a fund may be under-levered and they'll pay out through the leverage so that they can get their leverage ratio back up so they can produce more income for their investors. The second is the liquid bucket that they run. And this is where you're going to see some volatility in Q1. It's not because their loans are being priced down on the private side, but they may have a 15 or 20% in broadly syndicated loans. And as we know, that market is traded down. So you get some volatility from that, but it is liquid and they are able to sell it. So that produces income. But the most important part of the liquidity is your cash flows from your loans. Cash flows, both principal and interest, as things mature, as you're getting interest. and what's the runway that you're refilling and being able to pay out. And that's where you want to make sure that you have, not just 1 quarter of liquidity, but 2 years worth of liquidity when you stress test it out. And that's where we think actually these funds are in very, very good spot.
So at risk of at risk of podcast language, but it sounds to me, given all of the negative press, given the mismatch between investor understanding and opportunity, you guys are more positive on the space than you have been in some time.
It's always a give and take when you're talking to a credit person. More positive means less negative, really,
Right.
because we only come to negative than to base case. There's no, we don't really get over our skis at any point.
Thank goodness.
I would say we believe there's going to be more credit events going forward. There's going to be more dispersion going forward. And that's going to lead to great opportunities. In existing portfolios, I don't see real heavy risk. I see, maybe you have some exposure to some underperforming vintages, so you might have some lower performance, but I don't see like massive losses that people are talking about. And this is the other thing too. I know like there's a lot of headlines, oh, this group expects this amount of defaults, and this group expects that amount of defaults. Do the math. You could take those defaults and you add in a severity. So let's say you're going to do 15% defaults over the next 2 years, and you're going to have a 50% of losses, meaning you're only going to get 50% of your money back from those loans. All right, well, that's 7.5% that you're going to
Yeah.
lose over 2 years on a portfolio that's yielding 8 to 10%. So people don't lose money in credit because of defaults in a diversified portfolio. They lose money because they sell at the wrong time. They're forced sellers. So people didn't lose money in 2008 because of defaults. If all those banks were able to hold all that paper from 2008 to 2012, they would have been fine. But because they were highly levered, and they were levered with daily liquid or weekly liquidity instruments, right? Deposits and commercial paper and all that kind of stuff. They were forced to delever and forced to sell at the worst time, which was the greatest buying opportunity.
Right. I was like, and ergo born the private credit space that we now have today.
That's correct. That is actually 100% correct. So, what we've done today, and this is another thing I've been kind of talking about, is we've taken all that debt that used to be held by banks, right? And we've taken it and put it into, and that was, funded by, call it weekly liquidity at 10 times levered, right? Banks were at least 10 times levered. And some of those banks were 30 times levered. And then we took it all out and we put it in all these private vehicles that only pay out 5% a quarter and are only up to one time limit.
Right.
So is that destabilizing for the financial system? No, it's the exact opposite. Private credit is the most stabilizing thing for the financial system. It doesn't mean that it's going to be perfectly performing. Of course it won't. It doesn't mean it's not subject to the ebb and flow of the credit ecosystem. Of course it is. But it's still a very stable, very attractive asset class.
So my takeaway is, don't believe what you read, poke holes in the theories, and ask what's important because there's opportunity out there.
I'll add on, find your local credit expert and talk to them. They're there for you. That's what we do. I talk to countless numbers of clients, institutional wealth, whoever, and we talk through it. I believe in transparency. I believe in everything should be 100% transparent. We're not always right. We try not to have opinions that aren't based on numbers and facts. I don't know what the future holds. I don't think anybody does, but I do think that we have a very robust asset class that will, be able to carry through any kind of issues and continue to perform.
Awesome. You know where to find us. We're here to answer questions. No question is too small or too silly. We want all of our listeners to be able to find out opportunities that work well for them. And that's what we're here for. So thank you for joining us in Winged and Ready. Joe, thank you so much. This was very illuminating. And I hope you enjoyed it as our first episode in 2026. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that clients understand the ways in which we conduct business, that they carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide to them about the products or services we offer. For more information, visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG, member FINRA SIPC.